Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. The first Broward Sheriff's deputies who arrived at Stoneman Douglas High School on February 14th were told not to confront the gunman. According to a dispatch log reviewed by our partner, the Miami Herald, the sheriff's captain, who was first in charge in the scene, told officers to set up around the building. BSO neither confirmed nor denied such an order was given. The sheriff's office has said training and procedures to confront active shooters. This is just the latest detail adding pressure over the police response to the shooting. This week, the school resource officer, Scott Peterson, defended his actions. He stayed outside Building 12 during the shooting. Through his lawyer, Peterson said he thought the gunfire was coming from outside the building. Last week, he retired after being suspended from the force. And in court this week, the judge hearing the case against the confessed killer refused to step aside, as prosecutors may be preparing to take the case to a grand jury in Broward County in the week ahead. All this as the students at Stoneman Douglas returned to classes for the first time since 17 people were killed and 15 people hurt. The mounting pressure on police now, the prosecution of confessed killer Nicholas Cruz up first here on the Florida Roundup. You can join the conversation, your question, your comments, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also let us know what you're thinking on Twitter. Look for us at WLRN is our handle there. WLRN's Palm Beach reporter, Peter Hayden, is along with us here in studios in Miami. Patty Mazzei is the Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times. David Smiley, political reporter for our partner, the Miami Herald. And Kurt Anderson with the Associated Press, the legal writer here in South Florida. It's all four of you. Great to have you here on the Roundup. David, let me start with you. Your Herald colleagues got a look at a Broward Sheriff's Office dispatch log this week of the February 14th shooting as it was really evolving. What did the log show?
Well, the logs appear to show that a Parkland captain who initially took over the scene ordered deputies to set up a perimeter, which would be contrary to what we've heard Sheriff Scott Israel say deputies ought to be doing during an active shooting, which is to rush in and go after the killer and try to neutralize him. In his words. So BSO is not addressing whether that's indeed exactly what those logs show or not, but that's what they appear to show.
Patty Mazzei with the New York Times, what do we know so far? What have we learned this week about the police response?
Well, first we heard from Coral Springs, which was the neighboring city, the first officers to arrive, and they were the first ones to raise concerns about BSO's response here. It's important to note that BSO's written policy on active shooters specifically says that you don't have to listen to the supervisor or wait for the supervisor in order to decide what to do. They train deputies for these scenarios. Mm-hmm. And so even if a deputy was told to stay outside, if they thought a shooter was active inside a building, they could have still gone in, and that would have been okay according to protocol. It would not have been a violation.
And Peter Hayden, this all began a week ago with questions about the school resource officer, Scott Peterson, right, with Sheriff Israel coming to microphone last Thursday and describing how Sheriff Israel felt sick in the stomach when he learned of Officer Peterson's behavior and actions during the active shooting.
Yeah, exactly, Tom. Israel described it, Sheriff Israel described when he was talking about the deputy's response, saying, "I gave him a gun, I gave him a badge, I gave him the training. If he didn't have the heart to go in, not my fault, yeah, not my responsibility." However, as Patty mentioned, deputies have the authority to decide on the scene if they have real-time intelligence whether to go in or not to go into an active shooter situation. However, they are not required to go in. The Broward Sheriff's Office policy, mm-hmm, their policy says that they may, after getting this real-time intelligence, they may decide to go in or not.
Right. It doesn't say they shall go in or must go in.
No, but the way it was explained to me by one of the top, one of Scott Israel's top deputies, is that the may is because if the shooter is right behind the door and going in is just going to get the deputy killed, or mm-hmm, if the door is armed with a bomb,
right,
the deputy doesn't have to go in. And if you have shall, you're basically saying go in for your death, your guaranteed death. But those are the only reasons not to go in, your guaranteed death. Otherwise, you have to go in, even if you're by yourself, and hunt the shooter down to protect as many innocent lives as possible.
David, how about this this language of what we've learned about the policy of BSO and the engagement in an active shooter scenario? What's the focus here? Is it on this may or shall?
Well, I think what Patty's saying makes total sense. I mean, you can't have a bunch of lemmings rushing into a building. They have to have discretion. The question is why did deputies behave the way they appear to have in the initial moments when they arrived to the school, or in Peterson's case, when he arrived to the building and says he believed he heard shooting outside. I mean, he's acknowledged that he didn't go in. He apparently gave keys to Coral Springs SWAT team to go inside. So you know, I think the policy at this point is clear. What's not clear is why his deputies behaved the way they did.
800-743-9576. Your questions, your comments about what we continue to learn in real time about the law enforcement response to the February 14th mass shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. You are listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Patty, I recall back on the investigation and pressure that the Orlando Police Department was under after Pulse. And if you recall that, that shooting turned into a hostage situation,
correct,
essentially. And the OPD, the Orlando Police Department, was criticized about not engaging with that gunman right away. And the law enforcement pushed back to that to say, well, once the shooting, active shooting, stopped, it became a hostage situation. That's not the case here. However, this area that David's talking about, this investigation of how should and what happened, where are these questions that investigators are going to need to explore, and what kind of evidence is going to be out there for them to consider?
Well, according to Sheriff Israel, the only deputy who was on campus while the shooting was taking place was Scott Peterson, the school resource officer. So could the other deputies say, by the time we got there, by the time this order was given to set up a perimeter, there was no shooting, and so we couldn't hear sounds, we didn't know what was happening? Sure, maybe. Mm-hmm. Does that justify not going in looking for him? That will have to be probably for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement to decide as they review this shooting. I think that full radio dispatch transcript will be key. As will the statements from all of these officers who took part in the shooting and the witnesses themselves. I mean, the students and teachers who saw what happened, the first responders on the paramedic side who have said in Coral Springs' case that they were not allowed to go in as quickly as they would have liked, right, things like that. It's going to take a while to sort it out.
You mentioned the FDLE, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Peter Hayden, there's a few investigations here going on into the police response, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got the FDLE investigation, which was ordered by the governor. You've got the Florida House of Representatives has subpoenaed a lot of records, conducting their own investigation, and then BSO's own internal investigation into their, you know, how they responded to the shooting.
Peter Hayden covering Palm Beach for us and covering the law enforcement portion of the mass shooting at Stoneman Douglas here with us. We've got Patty Mazzei, the Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and David Smiley, political reporter for the Miami Herald. Kurt Anderson, Associated Press legal affairs writer, is also with us. Kurt, I know we want to talk about the court case here as well. I'm going to have you pull the microphone a little bit closer to you there as you know, while the investigation and the law enforcement response is ongoing, obviously the prosecution is ongoing as well. Some reports that there may be a grand jury now presented with some evidence. What have you been able to learn? What can you tell us?
Yes, it appears the grand jury will begin hearing evidence Tuesday and Wednesday of next week, most likely. In Broward County, typically, in a case like this, the grand jury meets about 21 days or so after the suspect is arrested. And what will happen there is there'll be an indictment. It will have the 17 murder charges, again, first-degree murder. And then they'll probably add a lot of other charges because you have a lot of attempted murder. Then you go into the secondary things like discharging a gun in a school and there's a number of
things.
They'll throw everything
in
there. Yeah.
Why go the route of a grand jury?
Well, in a case like this, which is death penalty implicated and so forth, many prosecutors, including State Attorney Michael Satz in Broward County, feel that they want to present the evidence before a panel of citizens to sort of review it rather than taking all the decisions themselves.
Instead of putting it in front of a judge.
Yeah. Because they have the power to just file the charges.
Right.
But in cases like this, usually it gets through sort of like a buffer, you might say.
Let's go to the phones in Weston, in the edge of the Everglades. We'll begin there here on the Florida Roundup. Brian, thank you for calling. You're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was listening to the panel, and I was one of the responding officers to that scene that day. And I just wanted to clarify that ever since Columbine, the active shooter response has changed greatly. Mm-hmm. And in the case where you do hear shots coming, you know, you're trained to just go in, because typically the shooter is going to be not focusing on the response coming in, but rather what they're shooting at. So it gives you a much better opportunity to take the shooter out. In the sense where you don't hear, maybe you hear shots and then they stop. At that point is when you're supposed to get as many people as you can to kind of like stack on the building or whatever the obstacle is, and then make entry, because you don't know where the person is or if they have hostages at that point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we responded, that's basically what we did. When we got there, we didn't hear shots. So we assembled, you know, attacked the building. Some of the guys were saying that, you know, they ran past people that were from another agency hiding behind cars while we stormed past.
Yeah.
And that's just, you know, it's one of those things where even if you don't know, that's what we get paid to do. You get paid to go into that building and, you know, possibly take a bullet, in this case, to save somebody else's child's life.
Brian, thank you for calling. Stay on the line. What agency are you with? Could you share that with us?
I don't want to go that route at this point.
Fair enough. You say that you were one of the responding officers to the Parkland shooting. Talk to us about the judgment that is necessary. You kind of referred to it a little bit in terms of as you're approaching an active shooter situation, if the gunfire stops and the kind of judgment calls that need to be made.
Mm-hmm. I mean, really what the training is, and this is one of the things that as a police officer, you have to have a mindset. You know, you have a gun, a badge, and, you know, some sort of hopefully body armor on, and you go the other way. You know, whenever everybody's running one way, you run the other way. So if you know shots are coming, as soon as our SRO put out that it was from, a building, a three-story building in the northeast corner of the campus, I was looking right at it. At that point, I jumped the wall, ran straight across the parking lot to the building. I didn't think about anything else. Mm-hmm. None of the guys that responded from the multiple agencies thought about anything else than getting inside that school and, number one, neutralizing the shooter if he's still there. But you got to help the kids. I mean, these are kids we're talking about. You know, we sign up for it. People apologize to me for what I had to do and what I had to see. But I told them, don't apologize to me. I signed up for this knowing what I'm getting into. Those kids are just trying to go to school that day.
Brian, what kind of firearm did you have?
I mean, I had my agency-issued patrol AR-15 and, my duty handgun with me as well.
And did you make it inside Building 12?
Yeah, I was on the east side entry team, so I was one of the first people in the building.
Well, Brian, thank you for the service. Thank you for sharing your story with us as well. We appreciate the perspective.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. David Smiley, Brian claiming to be one of the first responders there. What did you hear in his quick description?
I think I heard from him what police have been saying privately for days now, which is that they are trained and to protect these students, to protect people, and that they responded earnestly, wanting to rush in and try and stop this from happening. I'm really glad he called in. I think it's helpful to hear from somebody who was there on the scene, because I think there's a lot of second guessing, a lot of with partial information.
Yeah.
And that's part of the media's job is to dig and to start to try to make sense of what we have and what we know with what we can find out. But, you know, a lot of times, as Patty said, I think, you know, the FDLE is really in FDLE and BSO and even Broward County, which decided to hire their own investigator to look at this. You know, they're going to have the full picture. And at that point, we're going to have a better sense of what happened.
You could add your voice to our conversation here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN, talking about the continued mounting pressure and investigation into the police response to the Stoneman Douglas shooting, as well as the continued prosecution of the confessed killer, Nicholas Cruz. Let me pick up that portion of the story, Kurt, with you, Kurt Anderson with the Associated Press. You mentioned the potential of the death penalty in this
yes.
case. That has existed since February 14th. It has been talked about here. What are prosecutors weighing, and what kind of timeline are they operating under in order to make a decision?
Well, the timeline is very flexible on something like that. I would say the biggest thing would be looking at Mr. Cruz's background, his mental condition, which we all know was not good, just from what we've learned so far about his troubled past and all the many, many times that police were called to his residences for various things. The fact that he had killed small animals kind of in a brutal way, which is kind of a hallmark of a killer to be, so to speak. And they would weigh those kinds of things against what he did and decide, not that he's innocent because he had mental problems, but does the state have an interest in weighing that against putting him to death? And so I think those are the main things in this case. There's not the question of who did it. There's not a question of that there was another person. There's somebody we don't know. Right. His lawyer, the public defender in Broward County, has already said, we will plead guilty if you'll take the death penalty off the table, which is very unusual.
Very unusual. And prosecutors have not made a comment on regards to that offer yet, have they?
Well, they did in the way that sort of a around the horn way, you might say, where they said, well, in response to that, we're going to look at everything in this case, and we have not made a decision. However, this kind of crime is exactly what the death penalty was designed for.
Dan in Miami is calling in with the comment or question about the public defender in this case as well. Dan, you are on the radio. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it seems like there were some comments made in the newspaper that may call into question whether or not the public defender is able to represent this client. And I would just wonder if you could just comment on whether or not they would be appropriate at this point based on some of the comments.
Great question, Dan. Go ahead, Kurt.
Well, that's interesting, yes. There may be some inheritance of some size. I've seen numbers around $800,000 or something in that range.
This is an inheritance Nicholas Cruz could receive from his mother who passed away late last year.
Yes, yeah. for Nicholas Cruz. There's a separate action in probate court to determine what the scope of that is and then what to do about it. He has told people, according to reports, before the shooting, that he was going to get this money when he turned 22. So he's 19 now. Mm-hmm. So the way this would work is, right now the public defender is taking the case because he doesn't have this money. If he comes into the money after it's all over, then they will bill him. They'll basically put a lien on that money, assuming it exists, and use it to pay themselves back for representing him. And so that's kind of the scope of it right now. At the moment, he's considered indigent. He doesn't have any money. And the public defender is got the case.
Let me ask you about another role here, and this is the role of the judge in the case. Defense attorneys, I believe we learned this week, had filed some paperwork asking for the judge to step aside.
Yes.
What was the argument?
Very early on, there was a sort of a filing done with a different judge, because this one was unavailable, to in confidentiality, sealed filing, to have the judge allow the public defender's office access to Mr. Cruz, and I don't know exactly what it is because it's all been sealed and it's still sealed. And the judge that's actually presiding over the case then decided that, well, I want to weigh in on this. And when she did, she had a hearing where she made a lot of comments about we're not going to allow the defense to come in and have these kind of filings without notification to the state, and everything's got to be open, and I want everybody to be able to see everything, which, as a member of the media, that's
sure.
our position.
Transparency.
Exactly. Well, the defense thought that those comments were pro-prosecutorial and that she was showing a lack of neutrality. Mm-hmm. So they filed a motion to disqualify her. It's Broward Circuit Judge Elizabeth Scherer. And she just flatly denied it with one sentence. And so I guess that we're back to square one.
The judge herself said she would not step aside in this case.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's going to be the biggest case of her career, I think we can say.
Certainly in Broward Circuit Court. And so next week, what we'll be listening for and watching for is any kind of indictment that may come out of the grand jury, presuming that the secret jury actually meets and hears the evidence.
Yeah, and you know, if they get everything done in time, you know, it is all done in secret, and then the state attorney's office will announce the indictment, and then we'll get down the path of an arraignment where he'll enter a plea. And oftentimes, even though they've said they plead guilty, early on he'll plead not guilty, because that just keeps the process going.
Right.
they get all the evidence and discovery. This is going to take a long time.
Indeed. Speaking of which, back to the investigation, the law enforcement response. David, Patty, Peter, anything in the next week or so that we know of as the investigation and the pressure on Sheriff Israel, certainly in Broward County, potentially could mount?
I don't think we know of anything coming. They certainly seem to have stopped giving news conferences and interviews from the sheriff ever since he was on CNN on Sunday and said his called about his leadership amazing. So other than perhaps continued leaks of records, yeah, such of that, like that transcript, I'm not sure what else we'll see. Honestly, I think all of us have a bunch of pending public records requests,
sure,
with them,
yeah,
that will probably be pending for a while.
Yeah. Patty Mazzei, Miami Bureau Chief of the New York Times. David Smiley, thanks for your thoughts on this and sharing your work as well, too, David.
Thank you.
David, a reporter with our partner, the Miami Herald. Peter Hayden, always great to have you in the mothership here in Miami. Peter Hayden covers Palm Beach County for us here at WLRN. And Kurt Anderson, legal affairs writer for the Associated Press here in South Florida. Kurt, thanks for sharing your expertise as well.
Glad to be here.
We got more to come here on the Florida Roundup. Will he stay or will he go? The Miami-Dade School Superintendent has second thoughts about taking the top job in New York City and decides to stay. We talk about it with the Miami-Dade County Public School Board member coming up next.
Hi, I'm Michael Stock. Every Sunday on Folk and Acoustic Music, I bring you the best in contemporary and traditional bluegrass, blues, old-time music, and folk music. Plus, interviews this week live in the studio from Cincinnati, the Cincinnati Radio Band, and from France, Merrimé. The Public Storyteller with Dr. Karen Neal is at 4 o'clock. Folk and Acoustic Music, Sunday, starting at 2.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. More than a week ago, Miami-Dade School Superintendent Alberto Carvalho had agreed to become the New York City Schools Chancellor, according to that city's mayor's office. But after a hastily called school board meeting here in Miami and 3 hours of pleas to stay from the public and board members, Carvalho changed his mind.
I am breaking an agreement between adults to honor an agreement and a pact I have with the children of Miami.
It was a public meeting of an elected body like no other. The praise, the pleas, and even the pauses.
As we try to recruit other businesses to come here to Miami, one of the issues that we always faced was education. It's no longer the case.
You've always shown such a great level of discipline.
Mr. Carvalho, I think your work is not done. There are so many issues still we have to tackle, whether it's school safety that is on everybody's mind now.
I have had numerous lunches with you. I have seen you grow much like you have seen me grow.
Madam Chair?
Do you need another little recess?
I need another little recess.
Yes, sir.
That was the meeting leading up to Superintendent Carvalho reversing his decision and deciding to stay in Miami as the school's boss of Miami-Dade County Public Schools. Let us know your thoughts. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You could also send us a tweet at WLRN. A school board member, Dr. Larry Feldman, will join us in a moment. I want to welcome back Patty Mazzei with the New York Times and Kira Gurney, who covers education for our partner, the Miami Herald. I will note that the Miami-Dade County Public School District is the broadcast license holder of WLRN, but has no editorial control. Kira, take us back to Wednesday afternoon when the news first broke that Superintendent Carvalho would become the new school's chancellor in New York. Kira, we'll get to you in a moment. Patty, you want to tackle that part? Walk back kind of the timeline here on Wednesday. It was late afternoon, I believe, when a report out of Politico and then a report from your publication, the New York Times, had the longtime Dade County school superintendent going to New York.
Yeah, there was an interesting statement by New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. It's funny because the statement itself didn't say, you know, Alberto Carvalho accepted the offer, but it was clear that they only put it out because they knew he was coming, and certainly that's what City Hall sources in New York told reporters of the New York Times. And at that point, shortly after, there was an emergency meeting called for the Miami-Dade School Board for Thursday to discuss their future executive leadership. And I think most of us expected Mr. Carvalho to show up on Thursday and say he was going to New York.
And it certainly seemed by the superintendent's own statements that was what he walked in the door at 10 o'clock with in his mind. But by 1 o'clock, it had changed.
Yeah, what's interesting is even though New York was saying he's going to be our new chancellor, the office of Mr. Carvalho said on Wednesday night that he hadn't made a decision yet. And that's what he told people in Miami. So we still don't know if he didn't tell his office that he had said yes. But he later admitted on Thursday that he had said yes. Not only had he said yes a week ago.
Kira Gurney is with us now, education reporter for a part in the Miami Herald. Kira, describe the meeting atmosphere for the Dade County School Board on Thursday.
Well, I think social media users described it really well. I mean, they started this hashtag, the Carvalho Show. It really was a spectacle. There were children asking Carvalho for hugs. School board members gave these long 30-minute speeches about all of his accomplishments. I mean, you just had, you know, people joking about how much better the weather was in Miami. It went on for, I think, at least 2 hours before Carvalho spoke. And then he gave this maybe 30-minute speech talking about a lot of his issues that he is often vocal about, you know, immigration and gun control and that kind of thing. And then he asked for a break. And it was supposed to be a 5-minute break, and it went on for about 20 minutes. He came back, he spoke again for a few minutes, and then he asked for another break. Mm-hmm. So just the amount of drama and suspense was something I had never seen before, and I think surprised a lot of people.
Larry Feldman is with us. Dr. Feldman is a Miami-Dade County School Board member. Dr. Feldman, welcome back to WLRN. Thanks for sharing your time here today.
Good afternoon.
You and I saw each other Wednesday night, and you said that you had met with the superintendent Wednesday afternoon. What did he tell you? What was your impression about what he told you?
Well, the conversation revolved around making me aware that there was a consideration that he might be leaving, he was concerned that he wanted to make sure that people heard it from him first rather than on the news. And I appreciated that, and I shared that with him. We spoke a little bit about what the compensation he was getting, and he shared that with me, which was in the paper. Mm-hmm. And at the very end, I said, you know, is this a done deal or is this an open deal? And really, I did not get a solid answer. Mm-hmm. What I got was, I'm considering. It's considering. It's a good offer. It's a good place. And so I left.
And that was it.
And then we had our conversation.
I happened to see you maybe a few hours later. And I'm going to play back with you just a little bit of what you told me Wednesday night.
Why wouldn't he have told me to my face? We have a great relationship. And I think I deserve that if it's going to happen.
So do you feel that you were misled by the superintendent?
Silence. Here's the thing. And everybody has their own set of lenses on what happens and what occurs. And they have their own informal news sources, right? I can only go by what he tells me to my face. If, in fact, you know, that he had made a decision, which I just heard my colleague on my left say earlier, you know, that part is a question that he and I need to take up together. And if in fact that was not, and that came out of a different office, then I appreciate him talking to me face to face. You know, the bottom line really is this for me. I've been doing this 45 years. I started as a special ed teacher. And I really love what I do because I love my kids. I love my kids. There's no other question there. And so I can understand if that is the point from which he is using to jump off this diving board, either into one side or the other. If it's that, I say that as a very humbled, loyal, and the correct thing to do if you're in education. I'm not looking to move up as a legislator or anything else, and I would hope that people who sit in his seat understand that there has to be 100% dedication to only one thing. How do you improve the lives of all children? Mm-hmm. That's it. So when I have my set of lenses on, it's from a set that said, I choose to believe that there's a good intention. I choose to believe best intentions, and the other stuff on the outsides, I can't let it get to me because you don't know. This is a difficult position of being a board member.
Does what the superintendent communicated to you Wednesday and what he heard and what you said and listened to Thursday in the board meeting, does that make you question the motivations?
Good question. And everybody who's listening is going to come up with their own set of values from what I'm about to say. Dade County Public Schools is my connection to the world. I want the best for my connection. I want the best for every kid. He's here now. I can live with that. That's what I want. He is the best. He has proven it, along with a team effort with the board and all these people, all the folks in business communities. And so I'm happy there. And, you know, is this La La Land? No. Is everybody, you know, is it perfect? No. But for somebody to move the needle the way he has in conjunction and in collaboration with his staff and with us, that did not happen before, not to this degree. So I'm sitting in the chair that in a seat that says we don't have to look for someone right now. We have to finish the agenda, and his skill set for this agenda is exactly what we needed, which is bring in the grants, bring in the attention, bring in all the operations and innovations that he can.
We're speaking with Dr. Larry Feldman, a member of the Miami-Dade County School Board, here on WLRN on the Florida Roundup. Your questions, your comments, 800-743-9576. Kira Gurney is an education reporter for the Miami Herald. She's also along with us, as is Patty Mazzei, the Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Patty?
Well, I think, and I said this while the meeting was going on, Alberto Carvalho may be the most masterful politician in Dade County, even though he's never been on a ballot.
Or a politician.
Well, he would say he's not a politician. I think to be the superintendent of the fourth largest school district in the country, you basically have to be a politician. Of course, you know, that's just my view. But I think because everybody knows that he is that savvy in terms of politics and optics, he used to run sort of the communications and government affairs shop for the school district. So he knows how things are going to play out. I think that's why people question, how did this happen and why did it happen? Is it really that he changed his mind in the middle of this meeting? Or was he having second thoughts before, and that's why he was telling folks like Dr. Feldman, I'm not sure what I'm going to do? Was he just trying to kind of tell everybody at once at the meeting and sort of not have to have it all leak out piecemeal? Did the mayor in New York try to box him in some way by putting out that statement? Because it sounds like they agreed. Even Mr. Carvalho said all systems were go. So if they agreed, then why not tell people here that he was a yes? You know, and later change his mind if that's the case. So I think that's why people are questioning his intentions or motivations or how it happened, because he is such a savvy operator.
Right.
Did he not see it coming? Did it play out the way he expected it to? And we just don't know, because we can't get inside his head unless he tells us. And
to the point of how it played out, Dr. Feldman, on the Thursday meeting, there were an hour and a half, 2 hours of public comments, 3 minutes each, of a number of dignitaries and teachers and parents and mayors and children, as well as school board members like yourself, praising the agenda and the results of Superintendent Carvalho. Did you invite or request anybody to come to that meeting?
I was shocked. I invited no one. I requested nobody. My assumption, and it's wrong, presumption would be that we were going to the meeting, that we were going to, from my set of lenses, evoke, you know what, we're loyal to you, we hope you're loyal to us, we want you to stay, here's a vote of confidence, and let's go home after that. I really did not anticipate 4 hours. I did not anticipate the conversation that we all gave, not that it was bad. Again, if I can, and for the public listening, there's two pictures here. You know, the picture is what's behind the painting of that picture, and why did he use those colors that the painter and that kind of motif, versus I'm looking at the picture and it brings me joy. That is the kind of thing that's inspiring me to want to be an astronaut, because it's filled with stars and velvet sky. That's my perspective. My perspective is that sky and that picture are my children here.
So the process that played out Wednesday, Thursday, even a week ago, that is not something...
That's a different issue. That becomes an issue of trust and communication.
Sure.
and those things.
But doesn't that get to the agenda as well, and the ability to paint that picture in the future?
In the future. So I'm not sure that it won't happen. I'm not sure that there won't be conversations between the superintendent and each of us individually. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it belongs right now. I look forward to having a conversation with him. And as long as that picture's hanging, I don't have to go replace that with a new nail and a new and paint over the wall. Because the bottom line is, how do I serve my children in Dade County Public Schools, and how do we get the best painters here? There's no question we have amazing administrators and teachers, but if you don't have somebody cutting through the red tape elsewhere, we're not going to get. And you see that happen all the time. You see what we get versus other large school districts. Mm-hmm. And there is a big advantage in having the painter here right now.
I believe painters use blue tape, not red tape, for whatever that's worth, Dr.
We're Feldman. We're so far into that metaphor.
You know what? Maybe that's why my wife keeps telling me I have a line on that.
Kira Gurney, education reporter for the Miami Herald. Your thoughts on what you're hearing from Dr. Feldman. Any questions for him?
Well, I think, so I spoke with several other board members this morning just trying to get everybody's sense of what happened. And one school board member, Steve Gallen, described what happened yesterday as a political ambush. And he also said, quote, you know, it pains me to see words such as circus, spectacle, and reality show being associated with our district. And if you look at the New York tabloids today, I mean, they also had, mm-hmm. you know, de Blasio in a wedding gown as a jilted lover on the front cover. It seems that both de Blasio and Carvalho are sort of being mocked by some people, and others feel this is embarrassing. And my question for Dr. Feldman is if he feels like this, what happened yesterday, is in some way embarrassing or sort of a spectacle as far as the reputation of the school board.
That is an outstanding question. And quite frankly, you know, we believe that and defend everybody's right to have their own opinion. Having an opinion is not a fact. The fact is that this school system is the top school system in the United States right now. We are the urban winners of how we solve the problem to meet kids' needs. I do not view this. I do not view this as being a degrading thing for Dade County. This goes on all the time.
The meeting yesterday, or do you mean the results?
The result is not a bad thing for Dade County. The meeting, that's no different than people creating verbiage during presentations to make their point known. Was it taken too far? Well, it depends on who's the one doing the conversation, you know.
What do you think?
Some people that's their style. That's not my style. That's what I think. My style is not that. I don't have to embarrass somebody to prove a point. I don't have to use words and intimidate to get my point across. That's me.
Do you think that happened yesterday?
I think that folks came out, and this is not the first time they came out. This happened before, I believe. When it was time for contract time.
In terms of a contract
renewal. Exactly right. Exactly right. And they all gave their thing. Now, so it's terrible that people think that the circus went on. But that circus was not about Dade County School Board and students. That circus was about a process, however it was came about the process of what somebody or people thought was necessary to occur or just happened the way it occurred. It does not speak to the core of the nine people sitting up there, plus the others across from me, my superintendent, or the kids. And I really want people to understand that. I so respect the people in the room and Kira, but I don't want this to devolve into a personal thing.
Sure.
Well, because that's something you can take up with the personal person, mm-hmm. you know?
But to the agenda that is represented by the person, by the superintendent.
Our agenda, my friend, is to provide the best services and access to everyone. And quite frankly, if this is his way of being able to get more for us, so that every child, remember 16% of our kids are not graduating, as great as 84% is, mm-hmm. 16, if he can get me something else that I can do for those 16%, we're winners.
So to that, Dr. Feldman, yes. Does the process that played out in the last 36 hours or so, both personally with you and the superintendent, as well as publicly with the Miami-Dade County School Board, mm-hmm. does that process, including the vote of confidence that mm-hmm. the eight members present at the board gave unanimously to the superintendent, does that make it more difficult if there is future opposition on the board to the superintendent's agenda.
Absolutely not. I don't see anybody backing off on either side. I really don't. There's not a question of now I owe or he owes or she owes. This is about how to, at least my understanding is there were 9-8 people up there. We all thought that he was leaving. Is there any chance that we can keep you here? No one said I'm going to increase your salary.
There was no contract renegotiation.
No one said I'm going to give you 10 years. No one said I'm going to give you more money. No one said I'm going to give you a new car. It was only one question. Do you love us as much as this community has prospered under your supervision of putting together our policies into action? And if so, is that willing to stay here and finish a job? That's all I want my lens to say. So if I'm short-sighted, you know, I need to go to somebody. Seriously, and I don't mean it in a joke. If I see it very with blinders on, that's because for me, outside my blinders, that's entertainment. Inside my blinders is how does it impact my children?
Dr. Larry Feldman, member of the Miami-Dade County Public School Board. Dr. Feldman, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. This is really cool.
Patty Mazzei, the Miami Bureau Chief with the New York Times, and Kira Gurney, covering education for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from our Doral studios. Ladies, thank you for your time as well here on the Florida Roundup today.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you.
Still to come, we've got a little bit more. The DACA deadline that isn't, but thousands, including here in South Florida, remain in limbo. That's next. Stay tuned.
You're a visionary, an innovator, and a doer. You want to bring out the best in your community by creating the future instead of leaving it to chance. You want to make a big difference in the lives of others, and the Community Foundation of Broward can help make it happen. Your charitable giving can be proactive, impactful, and focused on the issues you care about. Learn more at cfbroward.org, the Community Foundation of Broward, for good, forever.
Miami-Dade College's Miami Film Festival celebrates its 35th year, March 19th through 18th, with red carpet premieres, world-renowned films and documentaries, parties, and master classes. Expand your world. Learn more at miamifilmfestival.com.
We're funded by WLRM members and by the law firm of Stearns, Weaver, Miller, Weisler, Olideff, and Sitterson, PA, with offices throughout Florida. Proud to be WLRN's longest continuous corporate underwriter.
We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Monday was supposed to be the day the Trump administration was going to stop renewing DACA permits, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The Trump administration had set March 5th, Monday, as the date after which it would no longer consider renewing DACA permits. But this week, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to review an appeals court decision blocking the deadline. There are two separate federal court rulings, actually, that have stopped the Monday deadline and require the federal government to consider DACA renewal permits. They do not require the government from considering anyone who'd never registered with the program before. All of this is happening with more than a million DACA recipients, including several thousand here in South Florida, remaining in immigration limbo. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN, back with us on the Roundup. So this is a deadline that isn't a deadline on the 5th, Tim. Is that fair to say?
No, it's been rendered moot by the courts, as you just pointed out. We've got three separate federal court rulings since January that have essentially said that the Trump administration's decision to wipe out DACA, the program set up by Trump's predecessor, President Obama, to extend this sort of temporary legalization status for the dreamers, as they're called, the people who were brought here illegally as children by undocumented immigrants. The courts are essentially telling the Trump administration that their verdict that Obama's action was illegal is itself illegal.
Right.
They call it arbitrary and capricious. Yeah. And so therefore, the Trump administration has to keep renewing, as you just said, these DACA work permits for the dreamers.
So it can't, the Trump administration on Monday can't just put pause on renewal of any permits. It has been ordered to continue to renew a permit. If a DACA permit, which is only extended for...
I think 2 years.
Is it 2 years? Yes. So if you've got a DACA permit that allows you to work legally in the United States. That's what these permits do. Mm-hmm. That runs out after March 5th. You are supposed to be able to file for renewal, and assuming you meet all the criteria, be able to get it.
That still has to be honored.
But you can't file for a DACA permit for the first time.
No,
under these court rulings.
No, not under these. That's the way the courts have outlined it, and the Supreme Court agrees at least that they should be able to keep. You know, the process going in terms of coming up with a definitive ruling.
In the meantime, there's another March date to pay attention to here, which is March 23rd.
Exactly.
And that's not related to a court case. It's not related to deferred action on childhood arrivals. It's not related to an Obama-era or a Trump-era executive order. It's all about paying the bills.
Exactly. And there's a lot of concern. I don't know if concern's the right word, but there's a lot of speculation that the Congress, which, as you and I know, sort of loves to punt, that this will give them essentially, you know, a fourth down opportunity to punt this issue. Because they could just slip into the government funding package an extension for DACA permits and compliance for another couple of years.
Right.
And that would simply delay things. And again, bring it really, I think, back to the courts. I think really this is the stage where we're going to see this issue finally resolved. I just don't see Congress really having the will or the interest.
Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona has proposed, I think, a 3-for-3 plan here. The idea was to extend the DACA permits for 3 years and award the administration 3 years worth of funding for its border security and wall efforts.
Well, that's very typical of Jeff Flake. He's a very reasonable, very sort of forward-looking legislator on immigration. The problem is you've got this loggerheads between the Democrats and President Trump, who is demanding a lot more border security, you know, $20 billion for a 700-mile-long wall along the border in order for him to get on board with, you know, getting DACA fully established and getting, for example, the Dreamers on a path to citizenship.
DACA, this Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, affects, what, about a million people in
about
the United States or so?
About 800,000,
There's another 10 million behind them of undocumented immigrants. This really is the tip of the spear when it comes to immigration.
Right. But those others, I think that's going to be have to be handled under a much larger, more comprehensive immigration reform package. I don't see Congress being even able to handle this narrower Dreamer issue, which is why I really do think it's going to have to come down to the courts, much in the same way the LGBT, gay marriage issue came down. And I think that would actually make sense if the Supreme Court were to be the one ultimately to rule on DACA, because the Dreamer movement learned a lot from the LGBT movement.
But the court this week said it wasn't going to hear this appeal.
Well, remember back in, you know, a few years ago, the Supreme Court was also waiting for the lower courts to sort of, you know, sift through gay marriage.
Right.
And then it ultimately came to the Supreme Court. That could happen this time.
So for folks who may have a family member or a colleague or a neighbor who has one of these work permits that's due to expire sometime this spring, what to do?
Do just what they've been doing. Really, I mean, according to the courts, the Trump, the Department of Homeland Security has to keep renewing these permits until things sort of, you know, rise up to the level of the Supreme Court where the Supreme Court finally says, okay, we're ready to start considering this. Because as I said, I don't see Congress in the near future coming up with a definitive solution to this.
Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN. Tim, always great to have you on the roundup. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Finally on the roundup this week, could this be the solution to bad traffic and bad drivers in South Florida? Well, Ford this week announced that Miami-Dade will be the first test site for its self-driving cars. The company wants to launch self-driving taxi service by 2021. You may have seen the car or cars already. They started driving on local roads on Tuesday, but Ford is not saying how many of them are here. Now, Miami won the gig, beating 9 other areas. Like a lot of transplants, Ford came because of the weather. Also, all the different driving conditions that we enjoy here, right? Ford's VP of Autonomous Vehicles and Electrification said they're looking to, quote, operate in some of the tougher areas that the technology will need to be developed for, end quote. Still, some of our listeners weren't so sure about the idea, like Barbie from Miami Beach. She sent us...
I'm torn. While I'm excited about the prospect of driverless cars, I feel their testing and presence in Miami-Dade with our crazy traffic and number one in road rage fame Wouldn't it be safer if they were tested in less populated areas instead?
Jenna in Coconut Grove would like to see more attention paid on public transit, not necessarily on autonomous driverless vehicles.
I feel like a lot of thought, time, and energy is being put into driverless cars. And I feel that if that same energy was put towards improving public transportation, that could alleviate many of the problems that driverless cars are also trying to alleviate.
But Oscar in Weston, count him in for a driverless trip. But he has some practical questions still.
I have absolutely no problems riding on any of these driverless cars. In fact, I will feel more secure. The only concern I have at this point is decision made by these automated cars when risk is imminent. For example, choosing on where to go when an accident involving pedestrians is unavoidable. The question will be, who is at fault? The car manufacturer? The owner?
Good questions there. And then there was this text from Marcelo in Coral Gables. Absolutely, he said. He's in. Any car with no driver is an improvement over 70% of all drivers in Miami. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Theresa Frontato is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Meritz. And our technical supervisor today is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, supporting, and listening to WLRN. Have a great weekend.